outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Did you hear the loud screaming in Wyoming?
The loud screaming in Wyoming?
Last Thursday? Did you not hear it?
No.
I reached a milestone last Thursday. Screamed so loud, I thought you'd heard it in Wyoming.
Okay, what happened?
After 50 years of playing golf, I got a hole in one.
No way. After back surgery and with cancer.
Who knew that was the key? The key is not to play golf for 13 months. And then I've played about five rounds of golf, maybe, since I've been back playing in a tournament.
No way.
Yeah.
And okay, Happy Gilmore. Now I'm going to make you a Happy Gilmore shirt and send it to you.
No, I don't need a Happy Gilmore shirt. Sheesh. That's not good golf. That's something else. But yeah, it was an 8-iron, 122 yards into the wind. I couldn't see it from where I hit it.
Yeah.
I knew it was a good shot. I figured it'd be good, be under the pin, just under the pin. And the guy on a forward tee from me turned around and goes, "That went in the hole." And he said it so matter of fact, I went, "What?" He goes, "Went in." He said, "A hole in one?" Said, "Yeah." And they turned around and hit a shot. And I was thinking, nah. So I walk up to the green. There's no ball on the green. Walk over to the hole, look down. There it lies. Bottom
of the hole. Oh, my gosh. That is awesome. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. It was kind of fun.
Did you jump up in the air and spin around and throw your club?
Actually, never screamed, never did anything. Just kind of picked it up. They were taking some video and me plucking the ball out of the hole. And I just went, yay, number one. And our team went on. So it was, and our team won the tournament. And I won money for getting it in the hole. And on,
nice.
On the shot. And yeah, that was fun.
That's awesome. Well, I experienced a interesting medical miracle this week, as well as
top my hole in one with something spiritual, huh? Wow.
Well, kind of. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
I found out that I am living with a prophet.
Is that your wife or one of your daughters?
My wife.
Or your daughter? So,
yes. Well, he might not be far off there, but no. So my sister was having her baby yesterday. And we were all excited and really looking forward to meeting my new nephew and the whole thing. But they had been really hoping, they have three boys, and they had been really hoping that this one was going to be a girl. And they did the ultrasound and all the different things and came back, it was going to be another boy. And so, there was some mild disappointment there, but then they settled in and were like, yeah, we're very excited. Can't wait to have another boy. And then last night, my wife is like, you know what, Kyle? I think she's going to have a girl. Just, they don't know. We have high range of medical technology. That doesn't happen anymore. We have ultrasounds. We're able to see that clearly. That doesn't happen anymore. I get a call from my sister this morning on video. And she said, hey, congratulations. You are an uncle again. By the way, we had a girl.
Wow.
And could not believe it. I could not believe that my wife had gotten it right and that the ultrasound tech had completely gotten it wrong twice.
Wow.
And my sister and my brother-in-law got blessed with the miracle daughter. So it was quite a morning this morning.
So by miracle, do you mean that God changed it in utero or they just got it wrong?
Just that they got it wrong and that my wife was prophetically aware of what had happened.
Okay. Birth is always a miracle, but I don't think the sex or the gender of the baby was changed in utero.
No, it was not changed in utero. No, okay. That is not the case. No.
And I have one more piece of great news to add to that.
Ooh, okay.
Lewis came by today and he's been, but those of you who don't know Lewis, my friend Lewis, if you haven't heard the podcast, My Friend Lewis, go hear it. It's something we recorded during the pandemic, Lewis and I. It's a story of his life. And I don't even know how to describe it. If you listen to the first 15 minutes and you don't like it, then you won't like it. But if you listen to the first 15 minutes and can stop, you're better than most people. Anyway, Miracle Life, he's my friend. He's here. He's not documented here, but we've been working with attorneys to try and make him legal. He was finally awarded a pardon for coming across the border.
Really?
Without permission. Yeah.
Wow.
Like some 35 years ago. And it wasn't by the president, believe me. It was through this long process we've been going through with attorneys because his mom needs him here for health reasons. And so this is the process to get a green card is to first get a pardon. And so we're at that stage.
Okay.
And, hopefully we get to throw a party soon. And it's going to take maybe a couple years before the green card thing works out. But anyway, hopefully my friend Lewis will be legal here before the ICE agents try and throw him out of the country.
Oh, that's incredible. That is so encouraging to hear. Oh, my goodness. Fun? Yeah. And just the journey that he has been on, because, I mean, the desire to do it the right way and the amount of red tape and bureaucracy that he has been trying to navigate and get through, and not a slacking citizen in the U.S. at all.
Nope.
Hardworking, huge heart for people, passion for young people. I mean, the example of the type of people that we would hope would want to immigrate to the United States.
And that we would want to have here. Absolutely.
Yes.
And don't get me started on the immigration thing, because I'm not real happy with the whole process going on in the world today.
I think I would second that.
It's strange. As our president encourages protesting overseas in Iran, he's against it in the States from people who are supposedly free to protest the actions of his government. Just a crazy upside down world we live in. And then you get in the whole Greenland thing. Tell me this, man. How is Trump's fascination with Greenland any different than Putin's fascination with Ukraine?
I can't. I need it
for security. Oh my gosh, what a crazy world we live in.
I can't. I mean, between Venezuela and Greenland, and it does not make any sense to me.
Anyway, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. Let me clarify something from last week. I read this, my best thing was the enemy's chief strategy is to make dead things look alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know where I got it. And then someone texted me and says, Sean Eldridge, he said that. And I'm
really,
I Googled that. I couldn't find it anywhere.
Okay.
They've said it. It's just not on the net anywhere. And then I was talking to someone this morning who said, I know where that quote came from. And I said, really? He said, yeah, the Sinai Code. And the Sinai Code is a book that Toby is writing about the very thing that Just Love is about. But it's more of a Jake kind of book. It's this guy opening to wisdom and this little plot thing. And I go, that's exactly where I got. I remember reading it in there. That's it came from.
Okay.
Thought we'd clarify the record.
Nice. Glad you were able to cite that properly.
Me too. So what's the best thing you heard this week, Kyle?
Well, I have been listening to the Divergent series, and it has been by Veronica Roth. Is that right? I think that's right.
They made movies of it. It's a dystopian future thing. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And there was a quote in the first book that caught me off guard that was quite enjoyable. It said, "We believe in ordinary acts of bravery, in the courage that drives one person to stand up for another." And I had to think, if we are not a nation that is in need of ordinary courage, or ordinary acts of bravery, I do not know. I don't know what else to say, because that, man, that just rang so true for me of, again, what does it look like in the day-to-day, in the life that each person is living, to not do these glorious superhero acts of whatever, but to engage in ordinary acts of bravery to stand up for another person.
You mean that's better than doing a Instagram post on how brave I am to say something that no one else is saying? Whole different world, isn't it?
Very, very different world. And just not connected to people, honestly. I mean, yes, you can put something out there on social media. You can put something out there in the world, and it definitely can have an impact. But to stand up, like you were just describing for Lewis, you and Sarah have been walking alongside of Lewis and his wife for quite a while in this whole dialogue. And to be able to walk alongside of another person in a meaningful way in some very challenging obstacles that are in their life, now that carries a huge weight in somebody's heart.
It does. I was talking to someone wrote me an email this week. In fact, I'm going to post it on the blog at some point, maybe even before this comes out, but they were talking about being with their grandson had a transgendered partner They were going to be with them, wouldn't have had any counsel about it. And the first thing I said is, you've been given a great gift. Mm. You've been given the gift to love somebody in the midst of a struggle instead of take a political position on an issue that you're not connected to in any relational way.
Wow.
And I think that's a powerful thing. It's a gift. It's a gift to be able to go, okay, I'm going to look at this now, not as the political issue I want to fight over, but the someone I love is involved in a situation, and how do I love them in the midst of it? And that's always the challenge.
You? What's the best thing you heard this
week? I'm going to give you the worst thing I heard last week.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, this came from a lady I was talking to, and she was talking about some of her career path and some of her time working for a lady in a Christian ministry environment.
Uh-oh.
And this is what came off her tongue. She said, she was my best friend. I was her best victim.
Oh, man. She was
my best friend.
Best friend.
And I was her best victim.
Wow.
She didn't realize till years later that she was just being taken advantage of. Just under the guise of friendship. And I can imagine a lot of people I've met over the years that could say that about the ministry stuff they got involved in. And maybe someone in the church I pastored could say, yeah, I thought I was your best friend. And then I turned out you were just using me to build. And I hope that's not true, but I wouldn't be surprised to hear somebody felt it that way. And that's kind of painful. So
well, honestly, that quote falls right in alignment with a lot of the conversations that I've been having over the last 10 days, 2 weeks. It is a very intriguing shift to me that I have been observing and hearing feedback on in our culture, that as people lose the understanding, the ability, the practice, the capacity to build genuine, authentic relationships with people in community, in real time with them, the more we see, the more I've been seeing and observing this shift to where it's like, okay, I'm just going to get whatever I can out of this person for as long as I can, because the relationship isn't going to last very long anyway. And it moving to this whole narcissistic perspective where there is no consideration of the other person's humanity. There isn't any curiosity. There isn't any respecting of boundaries. It's just, it is solely, this person is a piece of the relational pie. I'm going to eat this pie as long as I can eat from this piece of pie. And then when it's done, I'm just going to disregard it and go on to the next thing. And it is staggering to me how frequent, and not just in young people. This isn't people in their 40s, people in their 50s that I'm hearing this from. It is baffling to me.
So we're moving right past the best friend part, just to getting to best victim part.
That's yes. Like, oh my yeah, God. There is no friend. It is victim now.
Well, our society is so transitory that I don't expect any relationship to last very long.
Yeah.
So when it starts, I got to get everything good out of it I can. Imagine how self-centered that is, right? I got to get everything out of it I can before they move on.
Well, and if you think like, and the sad part is I think about this even in the context of faith and of more organizational, institutional Christianity. How many pastors have you heard say, I am just exhausted from people coming in saying, okay, I want the show, I want the program, I want the hyped sermon, and if that's not what you're going to give me, I'm going to go shopping somewhere else. And then vice versa, where the people who are in pastoral leadership or in ministry leadership are looking to, okay, you're here, and I'm going to use you for your gifts and your skill sets. I'm not going to actually get to know you, but I'm just going to use you for as long as you want to be active. And then when you're tired or when you are a body behind the bus, then we're just going to keep driving and wave to you behind from the back window.
I hope that's not most places.
I hope not either, but it is a trend that I started hearing in like the 2018, 2019, and post COVID, it has skyrocketed how many times I hear that from people.
I think that my generation, if you had the sense that this relationship wasn't going to last very long, you didn't engage it.
Yeah.
you just, the self-protection mode is I don't want to say goodbye to someone I care about. So I'm just not going to, but it wouldn't be, I'm going to use that person for all they got until they move on. I find myself, I have never had the thought and I've never heard it expressed by anyone that I know. Hey, I knew they came into my life. They're only going to be around a year or two. So I thought I'm going to get everything out of my can before they leave. I just go, oh my gosh, that is so the opposite of just love. It is so the opposite.
It is very much the opposite of just love. And it honestly, it's very much the opposite of, I think, the invitation of life and life to the full that Christ offers and that he modeled in Scripture. I mean, I can't think of a single justification in Scripture that would lead organizational institutions to thinking it's okay to use and burn out their quote unquote volunteers for the sake of the ministry or doing God's work. I mean, you don't see that in Scripture. Jesus is so relational and so connected to people. And the invitation is to walk alongside of him and that he leads by example. And I don't know.
Well, we got so much bigger things to do here. Can't be worried about the individual person. We're building up a ministry that will endure forever. And I can hear the rhetoric.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of using people. I mean, I fly on airplanes at times and I meet people when we're on the road with the RV, Sarah and me, and we go into a place and it's like, this relationship is at most going to last 3 hours on this flight. Yeah. I will never see them again, or 3 hours in this meeting. And to genuinely care, and here's the just love perspective, which isn't how much can I get from these people before I move on? It is what life that God has put in me can I impart to them that will be life to them? Not manipulated rhetoric, not trying to get a response that makes me feel good. Just what life can I impart to the person I may only know for an hour?
Yeah.
Or two. Or we just had the couple across the street that Sarah and I have really gotten to love and have a great time with and enjoy so much. They moved away a month ago. And you just go, okay, that's part of life. So the next person that moves in, whoever that's going to be, how do we love them? How do we impart them? How do we enjoy them to the full and not worry about? And I think that's the difference. If your life is coming from God, not people, the transitoriness of people doesn't matter, nor does it matter that I've got to get from them something that I'm incomplete in from my own fullness inside of God's reality. So I find that so abhorrent in so many ways to just say, how do I use this person to make my next step? But I know that happens a lot when just in the media stuff and people who, when the shack was arcing up big time, the people that would glom onto me and we're best friends. Remember we met years ago. I want this and here's my manuscript and blah, blah, blah. And then as soon as it's like, I didn't get excited about the manuscript. It wasn't the next shack that they thought it was. Then no, there was no friendship. There was no desire for friendship there.
Yeah.
There was no desire for an ongoing relationship. It was simply to use me as a stepping stone to something they wanted.
And here's
I didn't realize it was such an overt strategy. That's right.
Oh, it's, and here's my curiosity, because you introduced me to the idea of the yuck meter. And I feel like, and I don't know where to go with this, and I'm just kind of wrestling with this, but it's almost like people are having to dull down their yuck meter just to relationally survive. Because when people trespass on their boundaries or are seen to be manipulating them or are trying to pull things from them without any curiosity or genuine care for their humanity, it's like, oh, well, that's just the norm now. And so, you know, I'm just going to have to dull down my yuck meter. Because some of the conversations that I've heard from some people recently, the way that they were treated, it just made my stomach turn with the level of ick that it just, and that was just having the conversation. That wasn't actually being involved in the situation. And yet the ick was just like overwhelming. And so what does it take to accept or to think that, well, this is just the relational norm in our culture now, or this is just how it is in church, or this is just how it is, even honestly, like, the sad part is at times even translated to, well, this is how it is with my relationship with God. God expects me, I've got to follow these rules, I got to follow this law, I got to behave these ways. And if so, then, you know, maybe I'll get some blessings out of God from that way. But I have to, oh my gosh, I I was listening to a press release from the spokesperson for the White House, and they stated it this way. When we were talking about Trump and Greenland, this is how they stated it. He has a sacred obligation to, and then dot, 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 and proceeded to talk about. And I was just like, that term, sacred obligation, just pegged my yuck meter. It's like, hold on, you couldn't throw out a greater oxymoron if you tried to call it a sacred obligation. And yet there's so much that would fall under that category of, well, no, this is our sacred obligation, that this is what we need to do or have to do.
Yeah, my yuck meter just flew off the rails. It's laying over there on the floor somewhere. I have to go find it.
Blew out a spring and the dial's gone. And
I think one of the worst things we do, if you want to go on a lifelong adventure of being, of learning wholeheartedness and connection with the creator, it's to turn down your yuck meter. It's to honor it, to realize something's wrong here, and I need to ask some questions and explore what that is. I'm not going to just settle. I know we used settle in a really good way a couple of weeks ago about living in a settled body and not having the anxiety and all that, but to settle for less than my spiritual hunger in a community that's weighted toward guilt and weighted toward shame and is manipulative and exploitive. Boy, once you turn down the yuck meter, then everything that comes at you, you just end up settling for so much less than God's invited you to. And when you keep the yuck meter going, okay, I don't know why yet, but this unsettles me in a way, is to back off and explore and learn and not just go, I'll survive this by not caring that something in me is reacting to what's going on right now. Because that something may be a someone in you. It may be your flesh, your yuck meter. None of our yuck meters are finely tuned to perfection. But to learn where the yuck is coming from. Is it yuck because I'm not getting my way? Well, that's not good. But if it's yuck from the Spirit of God in you saying, this is not what I have for you. Mm. You don't have to put up with this. You don't have to go along. You don't have to pretend. You don't have to just, well, and this is what desperation does. I need this so much that I'm just going to have to tolerate how bad it is.
Yes.
If you honor your yuck meter, and I love the emails I get from people who really struggle going, I just couldn't stay involved because something in me was broken by what we were doing. Mm. And if you honor that, even when you don't see what the options are, if you honor it, then other doors will open. The other things will come your way because you're not settling for something less than God has for you. But if you settle, then you're not going to see the other doors. And this lifelong adventure to exploring who God is and how he's made you to be in the world, it really is following that rest when the Holy Spirit's involved, restlessness when I'm not, this is not what he has for me, which I describe as the yuck meter, which is simply the Holy Spirit in me alerting me to things, going, I wouldn't go here.
Yeah.
And do you honor it or do you not?
Well, and I think that honoring of it, honestly, is that first real practical step of living in your identity of the beloved. Because as we're talking about this, if you're operating out of a space of, or even not even, we're not talking by any means a perfect understanding of I am completely and totally loved by Christ. Not a perfect understanding that that is solely your identity. Even just the inkling that I am the beloved, and then choosing to honor that, choosing to say, no, okay, I'm going to honor myself, or I'm going to honor this boundary, or I'm going to honor that yuck meter. I feel like that's that first real practical step in saying, no, I'm going to live out of being the beloved of Christ. Now, I might not feel it all the time, and I might still be trying to untangle all of this, but I know that the value that I have in being his chosen and being loved by him without any condition, without any performance, without any yes ands, but just simply dwelling in that space, gosh, that's where all of this goes away. Your ability to be manipulated, your willingness to turn down the yuck meter, your willingness to settle for something that isn't wholehearted life and life in the full. Gosh.
Oof. And realize anything that argues against my belovedness is the lie.
Yes.
Because it's easy for us to go, okay, that feels true. I really am a scumbag and I really am worthless. And I really am being overwhelmed by what's coming at me right now. When you give into that, that becomes self-fulfilling.
Yep.
And so I was having this conversation with someone yesterday. When you stay in your belovedness and you realize whatever is arguing against that, I may not be living in it well, I may be struggling, but I'm no less beloved for the struggle than I am when I'm getting it all right. Are getting most of it right. And so anything that argues to the contrary is the lie. And if you give place to the lie, or if you accept the lie and you say, I'm being overwhelmed. So my prayer is, God, help me not be overwhelmed. Help. And the more I'm praying, I'm feeding the very lie that's seeking to suck me under.
Oh, that is so good. The fact that anything that challenges that you are the beloved, that is the lie. Man, talk about a good heart check of, okay, is this challenging or trying to diminish or dispute or undermine my core identity as being the beloved of Christ? If it is, then it is a lie. Straight up. That's authored by the author of life. Wow, talk about a test.
And that's where you can lean away from that and lean into my belovedness. And even in our prayer, it's not, oh God, take this away. It's, God, I'm not seeing how you see me right now. Would you open your eyes so that I can see? So it's not, take away my anxiety, take away my fear, take away my overwhelmness. No. God, help me learn to walk in your love. Help me to navigate this. I don't know. The night Sarah was first gone, laying in my bed at the middle of the night going, I don't know how you love me in this. I have no idea, but I know that you do. And I want you to teach me. And over the days and weeks that followed, he did exactly that.
Yeah.
Let me read something to you that's the opposite of what we've all been talking about today. Because I referred to this book, My Grandmother's Hands, a couple of podcasts ago. We talked about clean pain, dirty pain. Yep. There's something he said in the context of that I've wanted to come back and focus to. Because when I read this in the book, I was going, that's what Kyle has been for me in so many ways. And there's other people as well. But it says this: talking with another person to process what you learned or experienced doesn't mean having a friendly chat with them. It means describing an event that had meaning for you while the other person listens with caring, full attention, a calm presence, and a settled body. And that's in the good way of settled. This might involve both of you letting you tremble, cry, sway, shake your head, or even move your body in some other way that allows you to metabolize the experience. Therapists call this active listening. Being an active listener involves not interrupting, not making judgments, not asking questions other than to make sure you understand, and not giving advice or offering explanations, and not jumping in with a story of your own. It's important to reach out to others for this type of support. It's just as important to allow others to reach out to you for it. Mm. Isn't that a beautiful description of active listening? We're just the opposite of what we just talked about. Yeah. I exploit this relationship for all I need before it goes away. No, when I sit down and I hear somebody begin to tell me their story, that's what I want to hear. You've helped teach me that. Other things that God has. In fact, I had someone tell me the other day, I was in the home of a businessman that sold a business he created for over $60 million. And I was there for a number of people were in the home too. I didn't stay there, but I was with them. This is, I won't tell where it is. Anyway, the person who was in that room later said, you know what the man, the head of the home said about you when you left that? He said, Wayne is the best listener I've ever encountered. Hmm. And when he said it, I'm thinking, that's not the Wayne who used to be. That's a Wayne that Jesus has created in this journey. Because I younger ages, it was all about me, my next book, my ministry, what I wanted to do, what I wanted to accomplish. And God has made me now. When I sit down with people or I'm going to engage somebody, I really look at these things. I know I learned a lot of this from you, and I've learned it from others as well. But man, to give somebody my full attention, a calm presence, and let them process. This is, even when our yuck meters are going off and we're not sure my yuck meter's set well, or I'm casting aside my belovedness in the lie that's trying to penetrate my heart. If you have someone you can sit down and have this kind of conversation with, it just makes all the difference in the world. What you see, what you discover, what you explore.
Well, I'm trying to keep myself together and not have a strong emotional response on the podcast.
Oh, why not?
Thank you. That was a very honoring compliment, and I deeply appreciate that a lot. I think that is the best description of active listening I've ever heard. And I've heard a lot of definitions of active listening, and that is, I think, the best definition I've ever heard. I'm going to need you to send that to me, because
now people are going to ask, why don't you post it on the thing? So we'll post it in the podcast notes. So if you want that definition, we can get it to you.
Oh, that's great. No, we were just having a conversation in my intro to counseling skills class that just started up today. And that was one of the things that we were dialoguing about, is the ability. And this is coming from my former supervisor, who I think has been a huge, huge author in helping me learn how to be attuned with people. And we talked about, what does it mean to be present with someone, and the challenge that it is to really be present in today's world, and the level of gift that is to offer to someone, to learn how to pause, set aside other distractions, and to genuinely be present, a settled presence with another human being. That is such an amazing gift. And it doesn't require a PhD. Now, granted, some training and some help and some support and some mentorship can go a long way in helping build that skill and develop that skill in another person. But man, you don't need a PhD to learn how to be tuned, a gentle presence with another human being that's curious just about their humanity and not needing anything from them.
Yeah. When I read through it, I think, first of all, the thing of, boy, isn't it great to have someone like that in your life? And I've had it with numerous people. Dave Coleman was a really good listener for me. And I've had other people, Kevin Smith, folks in Ireland. There's just a lot. And folks I've known that more people wouldn't know who they are. But it's such a gift to sit down with somebody who's ready to do this with you. To ask questions, only to explore, to not top you with a better story, to not, when they hear about your hole-in-one, tell you, oh, they got one much more difficult hole somewhere else. And, you know, it's, and they want a pickup truck from Ford or whatever. It's lovely to be able to sit with somebody and have that. And then the backside of that now is, what a gift that is that you just said, what a gift that is to give to someone. To be in a conversation with somebody who begins to open the door, a crack on their life, and instead of rushing in to fill it with your story, you just take the time to be actively present with them and listen with a settled body, hold pain if it's pain, joy if it's joy, just hold the space with them. What a gift that is, and particularly in an area where you're feeling challenged and concerned or distressed, to have somebody inside that with you who let you explain the whole thing, who didn't, oh, I see what you're saying, and then kind of start giving advice. This is the opposite of active listening. I tell you, giving somebody advice seems like just the human compassionate thing to do, but it's not. It's the most destructive thing you can do unless somebody is asking you for advice. And I don't think they would ask you for advice until they're really certain that you understand the depth of what they're experiencing or what they're going through or the question that they have. When you get the depth of it, they might invite you in there.
Yeah.
But if not, then it's just, I'm trying to, and I think this is a lot of what advice is. I am disturbed by your need, by your sorrow, by your grief, by your hurt. And if I can give you advice, then I have fixed it and I can go away not carrying that any longer or not having to wrestle with it. Instead of, man, I'll hold that with you. I will sit in the middle of this with you and we'll both pray that God will show you a way through this, that you'll have that. And advice oftentimes, particularly, I hear it in meetings I do where people are starting to open up, and immediately the more nervous ones in the group will start giving it. Well, when I was there, I did this, I did that. I was going, no, that's not why they opened up. They didn't open up here. So they would get advice from everybody around the room. But there's people that just can't wait to throw the advice in there. And I think it's those, as I look back, it's not necessarily the healthiest people in the room. That's not who's giving advice. I think it's that they're unsettled by the need of someone else. and I want to fix it. I want to throw a Band-Aid on it so I feel better. It's It really isn't about them so much at that point.
Yeah, and I also see this a lot with people who've been in the helping professions. So I did a training with all of, there's 74 faculty members here at the college. And so I did a training with all of our full-time faculty, and we were talking about de-escalation and trauma and some different things. And so one of the active participation activities that we did was around listening. And so I had them, okay, I was like, all right, this is what I want you guys to do. I think you all would say that you're a decent listener. So we're going to practice. We're going to practice the art of listening. And so I had all these faculty members partner up, and one person had to talk about one of two things, either A, something that they were really passionate about, or something that they were really frustrated with. The other person could not speak the entire time. And I was going to run a clock. I was going to set a time limit, and that person was going to share what they were passionate about or share what they were frustrated with. And for that time, the person could not say a word, no feedback, nothing. It was hilarious, Wayne, because there were some people who were genuinely good listeners. You could tell that they'd practiced this. You could tell this was part of a rhythm in their life because they were just sitting calm, present, attuned, attentive. And I would say half the room that were supposed to be active listening were literally squirming in their seat. And I only had them talk for a minute and a half.
90 seconds.
And they were literally squirming in their seats because they weren't able to respond. It was hilarious and slightly disheartening.
And sad. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my goodness. So what did they learn?
Well, because when you're in a space where you're perceived as the professional, you're the educator, you're the person who's supposed to have the answers, then you get in that rhythm of giving advice, of giving feedback, of being the expert voice, instead of taking that step back and saying, no, I'm going to be curious. I am still the learner here. Yes, I have things to contribute. Yes, I have things to help guide people into a learning experience, but I am still very much learning alongside of my students. And so if you don't take that posture of humility and curiosity, then it's very, very easy to get sucked into the I'm the expert, I'm the one giving advice, I'm the one giving feedback. And so when there's a pause, or when a student comes and asks a question or is wanting to share something, the immediate response is to jump into that I'm the expert. And I think that's the case a lot with people who are also in full-time ministry. Is like, no, I'm paid to be the expert. I'm paid to be the one that has the answers. I'm paid to be the one who has the great relationship with God. And so when they come and they're telling me their story and they're asking for my advice or my feedback, or honestly, they're just sharing with me, there's like this underlying tension or expectation of I better have a very well-prepared spiritual response to be able to give this person. Instead of a curiosity of, Lord, what are you up to right now? Is there anything that you want me to say? Or do you want me to just be present with this person?
And that's not just for leadership type folks, right?
No. I mean,
almost every follower of Jesus thinks they have the answer for just about everything. And you hear all that all the time where people think, oh, scripture clearly says this. And then you go, okay, I'm sitting there, I'm going, I don't think so. I had somebody one time who's never lived on a farm. And I brought up that, you know, I grew up on a vineyard, and this guy was then telling me how to raise grapes. And he was wrong about 30% of what he was sharing. It was just absolutely not true. And there was a group of four or five of us here, and he suddenly launched into the expert on vineyard thing. I'm going, okay, I'm sitting right here. I grew up on a vineyard. I can tell you none of that's true. And yet I don't want to embarrass the guy in the
circle,
but there's something about us, and I think it's insecurity, whether it's from leadership perspective or from just a brother, sister in Christ perspective.
Yeah.
I want people to know I have spiritual wisdom. So I'm quick with the advice. I'm quick with the, I've got to get in here and help them know better than what they know. And usually our response for people like this, it has already been written in the first 30 seconds of hearing them talk. And now they haven't heard anything past that 30 seconds because they're trying to hold on to their thought and spew it out just as soon as that person over there breathes, even a minute, because somebody's not holding a clock saying, you got 90 seconds, you can't say anything. And they're just looking for a breath to take because now they can show off what they think they know, even, and they, and what you don't know is how often what you think you know isn't right. It's wrong, but you think you know it and you can't wait to dispense it on this person. And yet people seem to know. What I've noticed over time is people seem to know when something that comes back at them is genuine and they take it. Yeah. And other times they just kind of, oh boy, this person doesn't get it. And they walk away unchanged by the moment. That's why this gift of active listening, somebody give their full attention, a calm presence, who doesn't ask questions or doesn't top your story with their story. The only questions are to understand. I'm not sure what you said right there. Can you back up a little bit? Help me understand that. And to really be enough present with them and disconnected with your own stuff and what you would like to get active listening on enough to be with them through it. And what a great, you can give that to anybody. Somebody sitting next to you on a bus, someone that comes over and visits your house, whatever. You can give that gift to anybody.
That was the reason why in the last couple of trainings that I've done on de-escalation in relationships that we brought up and I had them do active listening as a part of the intervention techniques that they were listening to, because there are very few things more powerful than somebody who is really struggling to be given the gift of feeling genuinely heard. No additional judgment, no additional feedback. I was just genuinely heard. And that can take somebody who is really moving towards severe crisis and move them right across the crisis cycle and into de-escalation where they're moving back to baseline. They're able to take a deep breath. Now they are in a more present and calm space. And man, it is an incredibly powerful gift to just be present and honor the humanity of the other person with your curiosity.
And that doesn't come by telling somebody, I hear you, I see you.
No.
if you actually hear them and see them, you won't need to say it because it'll be apparent.
Yes, absolutely.
Saying it is usually, I'm not really doing that, but I want to say the right thing in this moment for them. And I just, to give that gift to people is just amazing.
So that makes me think of the comment that I heard on the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast, where one of the people in Mark Driscoll's echelon was talking about the book Real Marriage. And he made the comment, he said, as soon as you have to put real in front of something, you automatically know it's fake. I was just dying laughing because it comes alongside of that of, I hear you. As soon as you say that, it automatically is like, I don't think you do.
And we're almost saying it because you can see the disconnection and we're trying to invite it back. And boy, it's so much better to deal with reality than our fantasies, than trying to slap words on something when the reality isn't quite there.
Yeah.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.